in matters of divorce, God forbid.
Right.
So we have to understand that these things, you know, won't do the children any good. At least one of the parents needs to understand that this is not correct. If it happens, at least one of the parents need to keep it quiet. You know, if I am the father, for example, or the mother, and I see the father or the mother done a mistake, I should take it upon myself to keep it quiet, you know, let it go.
Critique later.
And then discuss it later.
Right, yeah.
I mean, no one says that parents have to agree on everything.
Right.
No one says that the father is infallible or the mother is infallible. Both male and female, husband and wife, they both make mistakes. Mother and father, they make mistakes.
We're not infallible.
Yeah. So since they make a mistake, well, give it time, you know. At least one of us should be at least aware of it. And if a mistake happens, let's just discuss it like adults.
Yeah, be the wise one.
Yeah. So instead of taking it out on the kids, we just need to be more careful and keep these family problems between us only and not involve the kids.
Right. Let's go ahead and take a quick break.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Be just between your children when granting things to them, in the same manner that you would like them to be just with you, in obedience and kindness.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the problem of having a different parenting style and parenting opinion when raising our children. Dear Sayyid, please pick up where you left off.
When parents get in fights and in arguments about raising their children, we said this will have a lot of effects on the child. And all these effects, obviously, they are not seen, but they are felt later on as the child grows older. The children who grow up in an environment where the parents constantly not agreeing on a method or, you know, a way of raising up their kids, you see, for example, it causes them to make a lot of bad mistakes. For example, like stealing, right? They start to steal.
How so? Just from seeing the parents argue?
Yeah. So when you see your parents argue and there's nothing, there's no more moral values being held in place, you become unstable. So you become, when you lack that kind of safety and security in the house, so we're just saying some of the things that happen. We're not saying this is what actually happens.
Right.
So it could happen, it could not happen, depending on the child.
So the child cannot differentiate what's right and wrong.
So for example, it causes the child fear. It causes him less self-respect or self-esteem. It will make his studies go a lot less. It makes him depressed. It makes him anxious. It makes him stressed out. And all these things, one leads to another. And each of these things has...
They're part of a chain.
So each one of them has like its own sub-chains.
Right.
So for example, when we say depression, when we say sadness, when we say worry, that has a sub-chain to it.
Right.
When we say
it's a chain
obviously
of events.
Not having, you know, being bad at your school, that will have sub-chains.
Right.
When we say, you know, you have fear... that have sub-chains. So each one will get you to do something. So the problem just keeps going deeper and deeper in the mind of the child.
But you said, just a question, you said that a child may also lose some self-esteem or self-respect. How so?
A child, in his nature, he looks up to his parents for role models.
Right.
And he sees his dad in a high regard as he is... he sees his father as Superman, and I don't know if we always used to say this, my dad could do this and my dad could break this. Because when we're young, when we look at our parents, we see them to be something great. I mean, from a child's eye.
Right.
Like, even when we were children, I remember there's a river in front of my house when I was a child. It looks like an ocean to me.
Yeah.
It's like a...
Or like your dad's hand.
Yeah, and then I left... when I was a kid, about 9 years old, I came back when I was about 35 to that place. So I haven't seen that place for many, many years. And I looked at the river, and it looks like it's just a tiny river. I said, right. What happened to this river? They said, that's how it was. I'm like, no.
No, maybe it got smaller.
They said to me, no, you were young, and your eyes were young, your brain was young, so you see everything big, which is true. So sometimes what happens as a child, you look at your parents, and you think he's someone that's, you know,
a godlike.
Yeah, a godlike. And so that gives you a bit of strength. That gives you, that your self-esteem goes higher, your confidence goes higher because you have that parent.
So because of the role model you follow, you see them crumble before
you. Same thing with the mother. You see her of being a giant and the love she gives and the emotion, the support that she gives you.
Right.
But when you see them killing each other and you're afraid that something is wrong is going in between.
Right.
One saying yes, one saying no, and they're having this argument. They both fall in they collapse in your mind.
Right.
And that's a problem. And
then the family
and
is
then
an
you
anchor.
Yourself, when you see your idols are fallen, you have no place
you're back
else
like
to go.
This. Many people say that parents, they're the anchor of the child. They're his support.
Yeah, they are
everything.
Exactly. Without them, when you see them in the state, you feel scared yourself. You don't have, there's nothing left for you.
Right. And with that, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sayyid for his insightful knowledge, and I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions or comments or some feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website, paristoday.com. Alternatively, if you're not such a big fan of these two methods, old-fashioned methods, you can also find us on the various social media sites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. In the United States, sparse telephone call records and missing documents hinder the House panel as it tries to piece together what former President Donald Trump was doing during the attack on Congress. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater, Jonathan Martin, Maggie Haberman, and Michael Schmidt. The piece is titled, Trump's Missing Call Logs Present a Challenge for January 6 Investigators. The House Committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol has discovered gaps in official White House telephone logs from the day of the riot, finding new records of calls by President Donald J. Trump from critical hours when investigators know that he was making them. Investigators have not uncovered evidence of any official records were tampered with or deleted, and it is well known that Donald Trump routinely used his personal cell phone and those of his aides to talk with other aides, congressional allies, and outside confidants, bypassing the normal channels of presidential communication. But the sparse call records present a major obstacle to a central element of the House panel's work, recreating what Donald Trump was doing behind closed doors during the assault on Congress by a mob of his supporters on 6th of January 2021. The gaps in the call logs were the latest in a string of revelations this week about the extent of Mr. Trump's flouting of the rules and norms of presidential conduct, and how his penchant for doing so has left an incomplete record of how he operated while in office. Some of the records that the January 6th committee has received had been ripped to shreds and taped back together, reflecting the former president's habit of tearing up documents. In addition, Donald Trump removed more than a dozen boxes of presidential records from the White House when he left office, which the National Archives believes contained classified material, according to a person briefed on the matter. The House Oversight Committee on Thursday, 10th of February, announced an investigation into what it called potential serious violations of the Presidential Records Act. Donald Trump has been loath to return the boxes of documents he took from the White House, despite repeated efforts by the National Archives to obtain them. At some point during a months-long negotiation between Mr. Trump's team and the agency, officials at the National Archives threatened to send a letter to Congress or the Department of Justice if he continued to withhold the boxes, according to a person familiar with private discussions who spoke about them on condition of anonymity. And while he was president, staff in the White House residence periodically discovered wads of printed paper clogging a toilet, leading them to believe that Donald Trump had attempted to flush documents, according to people familiar with the situation. He was known to do the same on foreign trips. It has been confirmed. The highly irregular practices underscore the challenge of creating a full historical record of a presidency that often operated outside of the bounds of long-standing rules. They have also prompted accusations of hypocrisy from Democrats, who recall how Donald Trump branded Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State worse than Watergate, and made Lock Her Up a campaign rallying cry in 2016. Republicans, who eagerly followed his lead in savaging Hillary Clinton for her email practices, have now been notably silent amid revelations that Mr. Trump spent his 4 years in office, and much of the time since, mishandling presidential records. The House panel investigating the 6th of January attack is still awaiting additional material from the National Archives and Records Administration, which keeps the official White House logs. The committee has also subpoenaed telecommunication companies for the personal cell phone records of a range of people connected to Donald Trump's inner circle. It is unknown whether the committee has specifically demanded records from Donald Trump's personal cell phone. The call logs obtained by the committee document who was calling the White House switchboard and what calls were being made from the White House to others. Two people familiar with the phone records discussed details about them on the condition of anonymity because they did not want to be identified discussing an ongoing congressional investigation. A spokesman for the House committee declined to comment. Since the attack on 6th of January 2021, former Trump administration officials have said that investigators would struggle to piece together a complete record of Donald Trump's conversations on that day because of his habit of using his and other people's cell phones. At least one person who tried to reach Donald Trump on his cell phone on 6th of January 2021 had their call picked up by one of his aides. It is unclear where Mr. Trump was at the time. Counterintelligence officials say it is highly risky for presidents to use their personal cell phones, as those phones almost certainly have no protection against spying by foreign adversaries. There is nothing in federal record-keeping laws that explicitly addresses whether a president can use a personal cell phone for official business. But the spirit of the law is that presidents should avoid doing so, and if they do, their call should still be memorialized, said Jason R. Barron, the former director of litigation at the National Archives. Jason R. Barron added, "Government agencies are supposed to document phone calls when the conversation is about important government business." Professor Barron, a professor at the University of Maryland, added, "A president choosing to use a personal cell phone on a sensitive matter of government business without the conversation being recorded anywhere raises serious questions about his compliance with the spirit of the Presidential Records Act." Little is known of what Donald Trump did inside the White House as rioters stormed the Capitol building. He was watching television as the riot played out on cable news, and several aides, including his own daughter Ivanka Trump, implored him to say something to try to get the rioters to stop. Nevertheless, his first public communication as the melee unfolded was a Twitter post attacking Vice President Mike Pence, who was presiding over the joint session of Congress to count the Electoral College votes. Mr. Trump also is known to have tried to reach out to one senator as a certification of the vote was delayed, and he fielded a call from Representative Kevin McCarthy, the top House Republican, who told Donald Trump that people were breaking into his office on Capitol Hill. Early on in his administration, Donald Trump was known to use a cell phone belonging to Keith Schiller, his personal bodyguard at Trump Tower, and later on the director of Oval Office Operations, for some of his phone calls. It meant the White House call logs were often an incomplete reflection of Donald Trump's contacts. After the Supreme Court ruled against Mr. Trump's efforts to block the release of hundreds of pages of presidential records, the National Archives turned over to the House panel investigating the riot voluminous documents that included daily presidential diaries, schedules, appointment information showing visitors to the White House, activity logs, call logs, and switchboard shift change checklists showing calls to Donald Trump and Mike Pence on 6th of January. Despite the lack of call records from the White House, the committee has learned in recent weeks that Donald Trump spoke on the phone with Mike Pence and Republican lawmakers on the morning of 6th of January 2021, as he pushed to overturn the election. For instance, Mr. Trump mistakenly called the phone of Senator Mike Lee Republican of Utah, thinking it was the number of Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama. Mike Lee then passed on the phone to Tommy Tuberville, who said he spoke to the former president for less than 10 minutes as rioters were breaking into the Capitol building. But many of the calls the committee is aware of did not show up in the official logs. The committee did receive evidence in the documents requested from the National Archives that Donald Trump had a call with Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, who led the flawed strategy on 6th of January of objecting to Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s victory in key states, according to two people familiar with the investigation. Jim Jordan has said he spoke with Donald Trump multiple times on that day. The Washington Post reported on Wednesday that Justice Department officials were weighing whether to investigate Donald Trump after the National Archives made a referral to the Justice Department asking it to examine Donald Trump's handling of White House records.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we would like to examine a question that often pops up in the minds of people. And that question is this. We know that the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, often ask the imams to heal them from sickness, from illness, from distress. Question that arises is this. Is this permissible? Or even before we ask the question of whether it's permissible or not, we have to ask, is this even possible? Is it possible for another human being to miraculously cure a human being who is ill? Obviously without the use of medicine and these kind of normal means of curement of these ailments. This is the question that we'd like to address today. We can answer this question in a number of ways. In a previous session, we answered this by examining some of the verses of the Holy Quran in which God Almighty mentions the fact that the Prophet Jesus, alayhi salam, cured the blind and the lepers by the permission of God in a miraculous way. And that the imams, being greater than the other Abrahamic prophets, were therefore also able to do this. But we can also address and answer this question in a more general fashion. And that's this, that we know that God Almighty is the essential and sole creator of everything in this world. And every effect that takes place in this world obviously takes place in it, by the permission of God. At the same time, God Almighty, He creates things. He creates things through certain means. There's a famous tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, in which the Imam has said, "Aballah an yajri al ashiya illa bil asbab." This tradition translates as God Almighty, He does not like to do things except through the suitable means. Obviously, when we say he doesn't like to do things except through certain means, it does not mean that it's possible for him to do things through without those means, but he doesn't want to, right? Because obviously here, the intention that we're referring to, the intention of God, is not like the intention of a human being. Rather, we're talking about a cosmological intention. And this tradition seeks to indicate that not doing things through certain means is actually essentially and rationally impossible. These things have to occur through certain means, and those other means are part of the cause of those events that and those effects that take place and are ultimately emanate from God. Now, these means through which God performs these tasks and does these things and creates these things are of two categories. Right? It's possible for one effect to have a number of causes. For example, certain causes which we know about, and there's other causes which we might not know about and which are unseen and unknown to us. In the case of miracles, we would like to say, and we would say that these miracles, they don't break this rule of causation. Rather, it's an instance where an effect is procured and brought into being through a set of causes which we were unaware about until now, or which we didn't have awareness of. One of those means is the prayer that we make to the imams, alayhim assalam, and also their granting healment and well-being to the people who ask them for this. Thank you for joining us on The Key. We were looking at the power of the imams, alayhim assalam, to cure. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have in many cases risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world, says Stephen Zunes, journalist, in an article titled "Democrats Attack Amnesty Report on Israeli Regime to Justify U.S. Complicity in Human Rights Abuses." Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. What may have also provoked such a fiery reaction is the section of the report which appears to be referring to the United States. It reads, "Apartheid has no place in our world, and states which choose to make allowances for Israel will find themselves on the wrong side of history. Governments who continue to supply Israel with arms and shield it from accountability at the UN are supporting a system of apartheid, undermining the international legal order, and exacerbating the suffering of the Palestinian people," unquote. It is this recognition that the United States has a moral and legal responsibility to end its support for violations of international humanitarian law committed by strategic allies that has led so many leading Democrats to side with the Republican right in its attacks on Amnesty International. This intensified in subsequent decades when the organization reported human rights abuses by U.S.-backed Latin American dictatorships and paramilitaries, exposed the massacres by U.S.-backed Indonesian forces in East Timor, criticized torture by U.S. interrogators in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere, and documented the large civilian death toll in airstrikes by U.S.-armed Israeli regime forces in the Gaza Strip and U.S.-armed Saudi forces in Yemen. this time as an indication of the rightward drift of the Democratic Party, the Biden administration and congressional Democratic leaders have agreed with the Republicans that research documenting violations of international humanitarian law by U.S. allies can no longer be tolerated. They have decided to take the political risks of attacking the world's leading human rights organization and lie about the contents of its reports to justify U.S. complicity in human rights abuses. Why would so many prominent Democrats risk alienating so many people in their base, including millions of liberals who have long supported Amnesty and other human rights groups, by making demonstrably false charges against this beloved and well-respected NGO? Perhaps they assume that relatively few people will actually read the report, and that enough of the public will believe their false claims about it to undermine Amnesty's reputation for fairness. Amnesty's reputation for critiquing human rights abuses across the board has been one of its greatest strengths. The organization has been critical of human rights abuses regardless of the violator's ideology, geopolitical alignment, ethnicity, religion, or anything else. The organization's reports have fueled movements to end U.S. culpability in war crimes, which threaten the profits of politically influential arms exporters. Perhaps the Biden administration and its supporters are making these false accusations that Amnesty International actually seeks to delegitimize or unfairly single out Israel in the hopes that it will damage Amnesty's reputation enough that reports about violations of international humanitarian law by other U.S. allies will not be taken seriously either. If the Biden administration and Democratic congressional leaders can get away with attacking Amnesty International for its criticisms of the Zionist regime's violations of international law, they could also start attacking Amnesty for its criticisms of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and other U.S. allies. Given the preeminence of Amnesty International in the global human rights movement, this is nothing less than a frontal attack on the human rights community as a whole. Making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have in many cases risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world. Even when Democratic leaders initially rejected calls for sanctions on white minority-ruled South Africa, they opposed military aid to the regime and were outspoken in their opposition to apartheid. By contrast, today, they support unconditional military aid to the Zionist regime, deny that the system imposed by that right-wing cabinet on the occupied West Bank is a form of apartheid and attack reputable human rights groups that present evidence otherwise. The Democrats figure that, with so many people scared of a Republican takeover of the House and Senate in November, human rights supporters will be reluctant to challenge their war on Amnesty and other groups. This may end up hurting the Democratic Party, however. With Biden administration officials, both the House and Senate majority leaders, heads of both the House and Senate Foreign Relations Committees, and scores of other congressional Democrats joining Fox News and the Republicans in attacking, misrepresenting, and outright lying in an effort to discredit and marginalize one of the world's foremost human rights organizations, people may start wondering whether they can support both human rights and Democratic Party.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army has vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles, from very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities. Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Talks are resumed in Vienna to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. This is the eighth round of such talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. has so far failed to remove its maximum pressure sanctions, which it imposed on Iran after the former pulled out of the JCPOA, and give guarantees that a future administration will not ditch the deal again. Now, Iran's top security chief said that there is no coherence coming from the U.S., on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal. Ali Shamkhani has stressed that the U.S. administration cannot impose the cost of its internal disputes on Iran.
And I think that now what we are witnessing is a division internally in the United States in the political establishment, both Democrats and Republicans, regarding a resolution to the ongoing situation with Iran regarding whether to go back to the table and to rejoin the JCPOA. We know that Biden has made overtures, and the State Department has said that they would grant some concessions in the forms of sanctions waivers. But like many Iranian commentators and politicians and diplomats have said, it doesn't go far enough.
Voices from the U.S. government show that there is no coherence in the country to make political decisions in the direction of advancements in the Vienna talks. The U.S. administration cannot pay for its internal disputes by violating Iran's legal rights. And voice from Iran and the P4+1 group of countries, Britain, France, Russia, and China, plus Germany, have been holding negotiations in the Austrian capital for 10 months in a bid to resurrect the JCPOA.
And I think that there's not much appetite for a deal with Iran at this point. I think the Trump administration did tremendous damage to the JCPOA by removing itself from it.
The new round of talks comes amid rising hawkish voices in the U.S. A group of 33 U.S. Republican senators, led by Senator Ted Cruz, wrote a letter to President Biden warning him that any deal with Iran on restoring the JCPOA requires Senate approval. The senators warned Biden that they will do everything in their power to block a possible deal if he moves forward without them. They also said that the implementation of any agreement will be severely if not terminally, hampered if the Biden administration does not fulfill a range of obligations in relation to congressional oversight over any agreements. The Republican senators said that if there is a deal that does not have Senate approval, it would be subject to being reversed as soon as there is a new president.
We see that the United States has been belligerent and has continued to put what it calls a maximum pressure campaign on the Iranian people, on the Iranian state, on the legal and legitimate Iranian government. And we see it as a web of coordinated activities by which we also know that Israel and the Zionist lobby are also pushing very heavily in the United States, in Washington.
The former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally left the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of his maximum pressure campaign. The pressure campaign was led by the Israeli and Arab lobby groups in the U.S. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden says it is willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage.
So I think that the internal divisions in the United States politically will continue to give free rein to the national security state in the United States to continue to put maximum pressure on Iran. But we know very well that Iran is a sovereign country and it will defend itself.
Iranian officials have repeatedly stressed that the onus falls on the U.S. to remove all illegal sanctions against the Islamic Republic in a verifiable manner and guarantee that a new U.S. administration would not breach the JCPOA again.
Neither East nor West, Islamic Republic. This famous slogan summarizes Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution and the people's fervent opposition to Cold War rivals, the United States and the Soviet Union, the two powers that then polarized the world sharply along the East-West divide. The slogan, which later became the Iranian foreign policy motto, was inspired by the ideas of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, who blamed the two powers for many problems faced by Iran and the Islamic world. He believed Muslims should reject the influence of both capitalism and communism. At the onset of the Islamic Revolution, many Iranians were tired of exploitation that culminated into Iran's losing big chunks of its territory to other countries. Therefore, the revolution kindled their hopes of independence and liberty. Iran's occupation by British and Russian empires in two world wars and the country's economic exploitation, directly or indirectly, were still fresh in the collective memory of Iranians. Also etched into people's psyche was how the U.S. and Britain engrossed their democratic aspirations in 1953 by orchestrating a coup against a popular government and returning the autocratic Shah to the throne. That coup consolidated the West's imperialistic agenda over Iran for a quarter of a century. In the 1970s, the Pahlavi regime was cheered by then-U.S. President Richard Nixon as one of, quote, America's cops on the beat in the Middle East for helping steer the oil-rich region away from the Soviet influence. In those days, the Pahlavi regime even obeyed the U.S. request to support its much-criticized war in Vietnam, sending warplanes, hosting American forces, and refueling warplanes. Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State under Nixon, admitted following the 1979 revolution that the Shah never failed to stand by the U.S. He described him as a man whom seven American presidents had lauded as a loyal ally. It was certainly a big blow for Washington to see the Shah ousted. The newly established Islamic Republic viewed both the U.S. and the Soviet Union as miscellaneous forces in international politics. The U.S. was referred to as the Great Satan, since it was the main backer of the Shah and posed the most immediate danger to the revolution. And the Soviet Union was regarded as the lesser Satan, since it was not seen as closely involved with the Iranian monarchy as the U.S.
The most dramatic symbol of the revolutionary determination to assert independence was the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in November 1979 by a number of students. Angered by the U.S. admission of Shah, they asked Washington to hand over the former despot, a request that was never met. Iran's relations with the Soviet Union and its allies were tense as well, although at a low intensity. Tehran was opposed to numerous Soviet international policies, particularly its invasion of Afghanistan. In 1988, Imam Khomeini sent a letter to then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, warning him of an immediate danger. That letter has gone down in history as insightful and prophetic, from the leader of an independent nation to a superpower.
If you hope at this juncture to solve the economic problems of socialism and communism by appealing to the centers of the Western capitalism, you will, far from remedying any ill of your society, commit a mistake which those to come will have to erase.
The post-revolutionary Iran has now consolidated itself regionally and globally, forming warm relations with independent countries across the board. With the disintegration of the Soviet Union, Iran also pursued a look to the East policy, engaging in close collaboration with Russia and China. The independent Iran is now being regarded as a power that has contributed a lot to make the West Asian region more stable and peaceful. One such instance is Iran's role in defeating Daesh terrorism in Iraq, Syria, and beyond. Undoubtedly, Iran's Islamic Revolution was one of the biggest social upheavals of the 20th century. 43 years on, Imam Khomeini's words still resonate, and his powerful ideas of liberation from imperialistic domination, independence in domestic and foreign affairs, as well as call for embracing social justice and harmony, continue to inspire not only Iranians, but people in the region and beyond.
In the limelight.
Despite repeated warnings from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that the U.S. is driving the rise of tensions at Ukraine's eastern border, the U.S. Air Force has deployed four B-52 bombers with nuclear capabilities to the U.K. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Amid Ukraine Tension, U.S. Deploys Nuclear-Ready B-52 Bombers to U.K. Stay tuned for more. Despite repeated warnings from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that the United States is driving the rise of tensions at Ukraine's eastern border, the U.S. Air Force has deployed four B-52 bombers with nuclear capabilities to the U.K., where one official acknowledged that the deployment is at least partially connected to Russia's recent military activities. Two B-2 Stratofortress aircrafts arrived at Royal Air Force Fairford recently, with two more falling. The bombers integrated with other NATO members' forces en route to Fairford, according to the Air Force, including British Typhoon aircraft and Portuguese F-16, currently assigned to NATO's Icelandic Air Policing Mission. The U.S. military downplayed the deployment, saying it was a long-planned bomber task force mission. But one U.K. defense source told The Telegraph, is this aligned to current tensions? Yes and no.